Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of the Damage Report Under Lockdown. We are here, and Matthias, no, you're not going to get to 1,000 likes before I get here. I'm here. We're dealing with what a lot of America is dealing with, a combination of the coronavirus and the fact that everyone is online simultaneously as we speak, and so it's causing internet problems. But we're going to do the best that we can, and when I say we, I mean me, but also Michael Shore. Welcome back to the show. Good to have you here.
Good to be here, whatever, however I may appear at the moment.
You know what? It's okay, and the audio is a little bit better than the video, which is what's important after all.
That's true.
That's true. Good. Yeah, I can hear you. I think this is going to work. Anyway, it's been a couple of weeks since you've been on. How have you been dealing with the lockdown?
You know, just going a little stir crazy like everybody else. My life is a picnic compared to many people, so I'm not going to, fetch about it, but it sucks.
It does. And by the way, I almost did this as a story with JR yesterday, but we got some indication that while California is easing certain types of things or whatever, and LA beaches have been opened up, apparently the LA specific lockdown might last at least 3 more months, which is
a
while.
That's a long time. Although, you know, that's what Barbara Ferrer, who is the Anthony Fauci of Los Angeles, said. Mayor Garcetti kind of cleared it up a little, saying it's not going to look exactly like this. There is going to be a gradual, reopening, and things will change during the course of that time. But getting back to normal is still months and months away.
Yeah. And by the way, we now have mandatory mask rules. Like, we had it obviously for stores and stuff like that. But just when you're outside, you're wearing a mask, which we hadn't currently had. So, look, it's good to live in a city that takes it seriously. That's nice.
That's true. It's such a non-inconvenience to have to deal with when you consider what the implications are. Mm-hmm. Doesn't matter.
Wait, are you saying that you wouldn't risk death to leave your mouth uncovered as you stroll around? I want people to see my lips.
I want them to see my Stanley Cup beard here, but it's, I'm just waiting for it to get like this big and then stick out of the mask and everything.
Exactly. Well, we're gonna check in on that beard as it grows week by week. With that, everyone who's already joined us in the channel, thank you so much for doing that. Wow, we are shooting up in the likes. I've seen your calls to see more figurines, Michael. People had requests to see some of the figurines that I've painted in the past when we hit 1,000 likes. So we are going to have more of that today. So,
excellent.
Michael, I'm just glad that it's you here and not Ben, because I would never hear the end of it. So,
but you know that I'm going to get off the phone and call Ben. So
that's okay. He's not going to care quite enough to go watch the video. So I should be okay.
That's true. That's right.
Exactly. So
unless it had him in it.
What's that?
Unless it had him in it.
Yeah, perhaps. Okay, so we've got that to look forward to. Everyone, continue to comment, send us tweets with hashtag TDR Live and also Super Chat, and we'll be reading some of those as we proceed through. We've got a lot of stories to get to. We're going to be talking about the ongoing Senate testimony. Senator Burr looks like he's going to have an interesting next couple of weeks or months. Terrible vote in the Senate yesterday. What's going on with kids and coronavirus? And at the end of the show, I don't know how much of this we're going to get to, we'll have to see, but we have two stories. One that's actual potential good news in the coronavirus, which is nice. Yeah. And then AOC told a joke on Twitter, and we've got reactions from men on Twitter. So that should be fun too. So anyway, with that, why don't we jump into the first story, Michael?
Let's do it.
So yesterday in the Senate, we had Dr. Fauci as well as others testifying. Today, we've got Dr. Rick Bright. That is the whistleblower that has been raising concerns about the government response and lack of response over coronavirus. And we had an idea of what he was going to say, but actually, thankfully, for when we're shooting, we have a bit of his video as well. So here is an ominous warning.
About better planning, 2020 could be the darkest winter in modern history. First and foremost, we need to be truthful with the American people. Americans deserve the truth. The truth must be based on science. We have the world's greatest scientist. Let us lead. Let us speak without fear of retribution. We must listen. Each of us can and must do our part now. On Tuesday, Dr. Fauci delivered a message in a voice that is clear and trustworthy as he encouraged us to act with caution as we return to our daily lives. We should listen to him and other scientists sharing their expertise.
So that seemed very reasonable. Now, look, he's saying we need to listen to the experts. We need to defer to them where possible. Obviously, we're not just going to do anything they say. But, you know, when he's also saying that theoretically, if we don't, we could face the darkest winter in modern history, that it's a dark winter we're looking forward to. And it looks like it's going to be a dark day of testimony as well.
It's pretty ominous. And, you know, one of the most striking things that he said there was, let us be able to speak freely without fear of retribution. So he's the personification of that, right? I mean, he's somebody who is going out and speaking freely now, but there's got to be some sort of fear of retribution there, because he is going against an administration, not just an administration, but an administration that we know what they do to their enemies, and we know that it's an election year and it could get even uglier. So as ominous as the winter could be, it may be a difficult fall also for Rick Bright and for the way that the administration and the candidate handled this crisis as well.
Exactly. And as we're filming this, I've only seen excerpts of a few of the people who are asking questions. But I know that one, I believe it was Mullins, a Republican, perhaps you can confirm that, was used his time to ask him about whether he was really as sick as he said he is, that he's on some sort of medical leave. But is it or do you really need to be? I mean, you can testify. So are you really that sick that you can't work? So honing in on the most important possible thing right at this particular time.
Yeah, I mean, that's the line of questioning, right? Let's rip into the validity of this testimony and this person who's going against the White House. But I will say, there is, and I would say it's a real trickle. I don't even want to exaggerate it as a trickle, but there is now a taste of distancing from the administration on the part of some Republicans. I've noticed it with Senate candidates. And maybe as these numbers, as we've said all along, as these numbers continue to fall for the president in certain places, that it's going to be easier for them to do that. Mark Wayne Mullen's not where it's going to start in Oklahoma. But I will say, though, that for the most part, people are asking questions that matter. But again, they're going to try and discredit this guy.
Yeah. And also, if you are watching this video right now, you saw that clip of Dr. Bright that we just played for you. And that means that now, if that's all that you've seen almost as much of his testimony as people watching Fox News, because they played it for a couple of minutes and then they cut away to have a conversation about the need to bring back Major League Baseball. And
I didn't know that. That's amazing.
It is amazing. I think they might have lasted between 4 and 5 minutes, so I'm exaggerating a little bit. Yeah. But that's not even the opening. That's not even the full opening remarks there. And we shouldn't be surprised, because what this guy is going to say is going to be critical, and they have no interest in that whatsoever. And they certainly don't want their audience to be exposed to it.
Right, right. And that's, that's par for the course. And that's exactly, they are the mouthpiece for the administration. We know that. I mean, we're not breaking any news here with it. But when you're reminded of it in that way, I mean, there's not much else on right now, right? I mean, this is Senate testimony, and people who follow politics are drooling for that. A news network is drooling for that. And there isn't baseball happening right now. So yeah. it's an amazing thing.
Yeah, it certainly is. And so, look, I mentioned the fact that Fox isn't going to show it to people, but that's also consistent with their programming recently, because Media Matters, you can head over, has an analysis of their coverage of coronavirus, which I believe it's the last 2-week period has fallen 20% from 2 weeks prior and 40% from the peak. So they're just not talking about it nearly as much. They've almost lost half of their coronavirus coverage on a daily basis because it's not serious anymore. I mean, you only have a couple of thousand people dying every day. Why would you devote time to covering that? You got to talk about Obamagate.
Let's talk about Obamagate, right? Let's focus on what everybody wants to hear about. Mm-hmm. I mean, there is a numbness to the news on coronavirus, right? It's bad news. It's constant. It doesn't change. And we're stuck at home, right? So I think that's sort of human nature to want to depart from that and talk about baseball. I'll talk about baseball with you, but not while there's somebody testifying about the administration's approach to coronavirus and the ominous facts about what, or the ominous predictions about what lies ahead for the nation, when, you know, over 80,000 people are dead because of this. So the just discounting it. I'd love to know in a serious way, I'd love to hear what the messages are like at Fox among the people deciding that we need to scale back. Is it as innocent? Of course it's not, but could it be innocent? Could it be totally agenda driven? And I'd love to know how that comes out more than anything.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we know that it leaked a couple days ago that Fox has sent messages to their employees saying they're extending the work from home order for Fox employees by another 30 days, which they right. should. That's responsible. You shouldn't be exposed to the virus just because you work at Fox. But it is fascinating to see show after show where hosts are saying you need to get back out there. Your rights have been stripped away. And they're saying that in front of a green screen in their mansion in New York.
Right.
They could go back. They could go film. Yeah. They could demonstrate. And by the way, they would be very safe even if they did that. But they are they are understandably worried about catching a fatal illness. And so they understand that their audience is not going to realize that they're clearly being manipulated and lied to by hypocrites who are protecting themselves while saying that they should expose themselves to lethal damage or danger to potentially help the stock market, a stock market that the people doing the working aren't going to be invested in, or if they are, barely at all. But the people sitting at home and broadcasting on Fox have tons of money in it. So it's just disgusting. It's disgusting from top to bottom.
Yep, I couldn't agree more.
And, you know, let's get a little bit more disgusting, because with Dr. Bright testifying, we know that Trump's not a fan of him, in particular because Dr. Bright has talked about the fact that he cautioned everyone against hydroxychloroquine internally when that was being promoted heavily on a daily basis by the president. So not too shocked to find out that Trump met the Rick Bright testimony with this message saying, "I don't know the so-called whistleblower Rick Bright, never met him or even heard of him, but to me he is a disgruntled employee, not liked or respected by people I spoke to, and who, with his attitude, should no longer be working for our government." So he polled a lot of people, pro and con, and figured out that they don't like Rick Bright. But also, it is funny that Rick Bright is like currently saying that he is facing retaliation for disagreeing with the Trump administration. So he's going to have to sort of prove with whatever evidence he has that there is retaliation. And as he's testifying, Trump is like, "He shouldn't be working for our government."
Right.
Just like the most direct retaliation.
No, that's really true. Yeah. And also, he was right, right? I mean, he was right about the medicine. He was right about the posture of the administration. It's constant and it's upsetting. But I, you know, the other side of it is like, yes, every whistleblower to some degree is a disgruntled employee. So I don't know that that's casting aspersions on Rick Bright either.
Yeah. Yeah. But look, so it's ridiculous, the attacks against him. From everything we know, he seems like he was just trying to be responsible. It's entirely possible that he's to some extent exaggerating the warnings that he gave. That is possible. People do that. But then let's find out. Let's have the communications released and all of that. Here is Dr. Bright this morning in Senate testimony talking about his early warnings for the need to stock up on personal protective equipment and the reception that that received inside of the federal government.
In your whistleblower filing, you discuss a February 7th meeting of the department leadership group, at which you urged the department to focus on securing N95 masks. Can you describe what happened at that meeting?
They informed me that they did not believe there was a critical urgency to procure masks. They conducted some surveys, talked to a few hospitals and some companies, and they didn't yet see a critical shortage. And I indicated that we know there will be a critical shortage of these supplies. We need to do something to ramp up production. They indicated if we notice there is a shortage that we will simply change the CDC guidelines to better inform people who should not be wearing those masks, so that would save those masks for our healthcare workers. My response was, "I cannot believe you can sit and say that with a straight face."
So saying that he warned them about the need for PPE and they said, "Hey, we just talked to some hospitals. They're not running out." Well, yeah, it hadn't hit yet. They hadn't needed to go through them, and saying, "We'll just ask them to stop using it for other stuff." What are you talking about? How is that a responsible approach to protecting the front line, the first responders for this pandemic?
You're right. I mean, that's obviously what that is. But also, if I'm not mistaken, this is in early January that these conversations happened, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, this was just after the new year, way before we've had this, you know, this crisis and these shutdowns. Is that right, John? I'm asking.
I believe so. Yes. Yes.
I think that's what he's talking about. So this talks to preparedness, which is what the White House has been criticized for extensively. And now you have somebody who was on the inside of it, you know, saying that, you know, he can't believe that they're saying it with a straight face. I mean, that's what we all have. We all share this disbelief.
Exactly. And look, I went to see how many nurses and doctors have died from coronavirus. And depending on what source you go to, you get wildly disparate numbers. But we do know that it's hundreds at the very least. God only knows what we'll find out in the end. And you have to wonder, when they were required to work effectively nonstop, taking the briefest breaks to sleep very briefly and then go back to work, and the masks ran out, so they have to start using bandanas and bits of cloth and things like that. I mean, they were exposed to coronavirus because we weren't ready, and we weren't ready because the people who could have made sure that we were ready didn't care to do so, didn't think that it was important. Or, I mean, look, we're not even doing a full story on it, but the report, I think from Financial Times, they talked to people saying that they didn't want to do more testing early on because they were worried it would spook the markets. Maybe ordering the production of masks by the millions would have spooked the markets, and maybe that's something that was a consideration. But we know that...
Guess the result spooked the markets. And guess what? The markets came back because everybody figured it out, what was going on. Mm-hmm. And there was certainty. So, yeah, spooking the markets. God, if that's the worst thing that happened, yeah, you know, great.
Yeah. That's to some people, that's a worst case scenario.
Yeah.
For me, a worst case scenario is something like 85,000 plus Americans dying. But we have different priorities. Different people. But anyway, they could have ramped up production in January or in February or in March, or seemingly in April. At some point, they could have started doing this. And not just for the masks and the gowns and things like that, but also like syringes and swabs. And I just read a report about one of the things that's going to cause difficulty in making the vaccine available to the hundreds of millions of people it'll be necessary for here in this country, is that we don't currently have the capacity for the vials that it's held in because of the high quality medicinal grade river glass river glass produced from the sand from rivers that's going to be necessary. Okay, well then take it seriously now, so that in 6 to 12 months or 18, when we have the vaccine, we have the rubber seals and all of that that they're saying we still don't currently have. But right. I worry that the same people who are ignoring Bright's testimony today about the warnings that were ignored then might be ignoring the things now that are going to be disasters. Things like making the vaccine accessible. The warnings from people like AOC about the fact that we're going to have a gigantic amount of foreclosures and things like that happening over the next couple of months. And I don't hear the government talking about that. And so, like, it's one thing to just look back with hindsight about the disastrous response so far, but to look around and to see the next set of disastrous, ill-prepared moves from the government, that is truly disheartening, especially as we are still dealing with the fallout from the first.
Yeah, and Bright is doing now what he did then. He's saying, you got to prepare, because it's going to be a long, dark winter, right? So if they're not listening to him now, like they didn't listen to him before, then that portends what it does, which is not good.
Exactly.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be. Featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity, the UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it, you must unlearn what you have learned. And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
We've known for some time, thanks to the work of Public Integrity, that some senators, including Richard Burr, appeared to have used the private information that they had as our country got closer and closer to experiencing the pandemic, and used that to avoid losing a great deal of money on the stock market. That is what it appears happened. And it appears that more people are taking this seriously, because we found out over the last day that FBI agents reportedly seized Senator Richard Burr's cell phone. He's the chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee, and they did that as part of an investigation into stock trades he made before the market plunged due to the coronavirus pandemic. They apparently seized his cell phone after a search warrant. They showed up at his residence. And we have a little bit more information about how they got to that point. We don't have a ton more information, but we do know that this is not something that the FBI just does willy-nilly, right, Michael? That they would do this to, you know, a powerful Republican right. senator. Like, that seems like the sort of thing that they would probably have to have a pretty high threshold before they pull the trigger on that.
Right. There are different thresholds to it. This is a really underratedly fascinating story because it's a political drama in a sense. Richard Burr is not well liked by the White House. They don't like the fact that as chair of the Intelligence Committee, he was a thorn in the side of the White House when investigating and, you know, assessing that, yes, Russia did try and hack into the 2016 election. There was meddling. The White House didn't like that narrative. And they've had it in a little bit for Richard Burr for quite a while. So he is the one, even though there were others like Kelly Loeffler, who he's the one that they actually executed a search warrant on. The fact that they had a search warrant at the Justice Department, the FBI, for that means, to me anyway, I'm reading into wondering whether or not the president or the White House had influenced that. The fact that Chuck Schumer wasn't saying he should step aside as intelligence chair tells me that they're happy that this thorn in the side of the president is an intelligence chair, especially when you have Obamagate being whispered about in the House. Then you move to the fact that he's stepping aside now. McConnell's saying, all right,
yes,
that until this investigation is over with, he is going to be sidelined as chairman of the Intelligence Committee. It all fits a narrative that the White House doesn't like Richard Burr. They don't care that much about Richard Burr. He's not someone they're investing in right now. Mm-hmm. To me, it's a fascinating, it goes deeper than what Richard Burr did. Egregious and terrible. It's clear that there was a connection between he and his brother-in-law. The fact that they sold their stocks at the same time, just ahead of the coronavirus, just after he had secret intelligence briefings. But the point that they're going after this guy and not anybody else tells me there's more to the story.
Yeah. So I would still be, if I was Kelly Loeffler, I'd be thinking a little bit about potentially what might happen, but. Yeah, no, you bring up a good point. This just randomly occurs to me. It probably has absolutely nothing. But do you think that if there is going to be a continuing battle over what happens to Michael Flynn, that the fact that he's the chair of the Intelligence Committee, do you think that that plays any role, or is that just totally disconnected?
I don't, because I think their work is done there. I think it goes to any, if there's any problem with it, it would go to the Judiciary Committee anyway, because it's a miscarriage of justice. But I think it's going to be handled in the courts and not in Congress. I mean, for now.
Well, thank you for sorry.
Yeah, go ahead.
Thank you for mentioning that he is being sidelined as chair. I don't think as of when we're talking, they know for sure who's going to take his place. But I did see that it might be Rubio that might actually take over.
Yeah.
So we'll have to see. What we do know, though, is the FBI apparently served a warrant to Apple to get information from Burr's iCloud account, according to the Times, citing an unnamed law enforcement official. The data that the FBI agents got from Apple was then used as part of the evidence needed to obtain a warrant for Burr's phone. And in case you have not been following this or watching the show for the past couple of months, Burr sold off between $628,000 and $1.72 million of his holdings on February 13th in 33 separate transactions. This is from ProPublica. And so, again, he's not the only one, perhaps not even the most egregious, although he's right up there. We'll have to see. And just sort of like an interesting note is that when the Stock Act was passed, which effectively made the sort of thing that he's being alleged to have done illegal, only three senators voted against it, and he was one of them. A wise choice on his part, but unfortunately he didn't learn anything by the fact that it's still passed anyway. Just out of curiosity, there's like no chance. Michael, do you know either of the other two?
Who voted
against it?
Oh, wow. No, I will say that the other two, you say there's no chance.
I wouldn't have even asked anyone else. I thought you have the only chance of knowing any.
Yeah, no, I mean, my guess is there would be Rand Paul and Mike Lee.
Those are both great guesses, but no, it's Bingaman and Coburn.
Oh, God. Yeah, it was that Congress. That's right. And Jeff Bingaman didn't like the way that it was debated, and that's why he voted against it. Former senator from New Mexico. And Coburn just passed away, Tom Coburn.
Yeah. Well, you didn't get either, but your explanation afterwards worth a few points at the very least.
Well, but here's the other part of this is, you know, the politics. I was talking to Emma Vigeland about this today via text, because she sent a text out saying how weak it was of Chuck Schumer to not call for his stepping aside. I actually thought it was the opposite. I thought, you know, it wasn't strength. It was just smart. I thought it was clever because they want to see the Republicans crumble on their own. And it's important, too, because they know that the White House isn't happy about this. The other side of it is, why not go after Loeffler? Well, the Democrats want Loeffler to get the nomination against Doug Collins because they think they have a better shot of beating her in Georgia. And that opens up lots of different conversations, everything from who could be vice presidential nominee down to who's going to run the Senate next time. So it's all interesting conversation.
Well, we'll be watching. I mean, I can only speak for myself, but I've wanted some consequences for this. And not just like individual criminal consequences, because it seems horrible to be trying to save yourself money while publicly saying, we got this. Nobody worry about anything. But also legislative consequences. I think the Stock Act obviously needs to be massively strengthened. I don't think that they should be allowed to own individual stocks or have any direct control over their trading when they can have an effect on the markets, an obvious, direct, predictable effect on the markets, positive or negative. They should not be in a position to benefit financially off of that. There might be some individuals in this country who are so financially selfless that they would think about the country and not their stock portfolio. Those sorts of people, in my experience, don't tend to run for office. So I don't trust I don't trust them to own stocks, personally.
What do you think of blind trust, though? Do you think that that's...
potentially.
Yeah.
Look, if that's what we could get, then I would be happy with that.
Yeah, I think that that should be the law and that should be what it is. I also think that, you know, you prevent some people who would probably be pretty good at running for office who, you know, if they couldn't invest at all, any of their savings, any of their money that they've worked for in any kind of stock market. But I do think the blind trust is obviously something that should happen, and they should never be allowed to even know who's controlling it personally, just sort of hand it over.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and I don't remember
Not anybody in the family either. They're totally separate from a family member. Oh, I'm giving this to my brother. He handles all my stuff. No, that doesn't matter.
So you're not satisfied with, like, your two idiot sons running your business while you're president or anything?
I only have one idiot son.
Now, I'm talking about Trump, obviously.
Oh, okay.
Not you. I'm not insulting your awesome kid.
I know.
Anyway.
I know what you were saying.
Yes, okay. Anyway, so let's see what happens. This week, everyone watching to see what's going to happen with your internet search history. Will William Barr and others just be able to warrantlessly collect that, potentially use that information? Well, there was an attempt via amendment to block that, and that has failed. The Senate on Thursday took up a key bill to reauthorize domestic surveillance programs while making changes to the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, with several substantial amendments on the line. One of them, the one we're talking about here, introduced by Democratic Senator Ron Wyden and Republican Senator Steve Daines, would have required authorities to obtain a warrant to access internet users' search histories and browsing information. That fell short by a single vote after four senators who presumably would have voted yes failed to show up to the session, including Bernie Sanders, by the way, which we mentioned here. We'll have more on that. Nine Democratic senators also voted no, so against protecting people from that sort of warrantless seizure of your internet activity, causing the amendment to fall short of the 60-vote threshold it needed to pass. I'm assuming implicitly there that it's just that standing implicit filibuster for everything. So,
yeah.
But anyway, we're going to have more on this. We've got some names that we would like to name. But I don't believe that we had talked about this beforehand. What were your expectations going to that vote?
Well, I didn't think they were going to get enough. And I think that I think that most of the senators, or many of the senators, were sort of caught unaware by this and don't know enough about it, which is why I think that you had a lot of people sitting out, that it's kind of a, you know, it's the legacy of Richard Nixon in the modern day. Right. I mean, you're not pushing play record on a tape deck. You're actually going in and looking at the internet history, and you're allowing the head of the Justice Department, the Attorney General, to do that. Someone who would have political motivation right from the outset. I think that there were a lot of senators who just weren't prepared for that to be on the table and had to look into it further, which is what senators sometimes do when you see that they didn't vote. Sometimes they're logistics, sometimes they're lazy. But sometimes it's because they don't know enough, and there's enough of them to say, "Hey, we're going to sit this out. It's going to be tabled until we can get on it."
Yeah. Well, we're gonna turn to the people who didn't vote in a sec. Let's go to the people who voted against it. These are Democrats voting against it. We've got Carper, Casey, Feinstein, Hassan, Jones, Kaine, Tim Kaine, VP nominee, Tim Kaine, Manchin, not really surprising, Shaheen, Warner, and Whitehouse. Yeah. If I was going to just try to come up with some names, I would have gotten at least 30% of that, probably, maybe 40 or 50.
I don't think I would have. I wouldn't have gotten a lot of them. Hmm. I wouldn't have gotten Shaheen and Hassan and Whitehouse for sure. I would not have thought that that's where they would be. And I don't know that they know that that's where they are right now. I mean, I really think that there's going to be a lot of airing this out before it just happens.
Yeah. Well, let me give you the brief response of one of the two who sponsored the amendment, Ron Wyden, who said, 59 members of the Senate just voted in favor of my amendment to block warrantless government surveillance of Americans' browser history. It failed by just one vote. McConnell is that much closer to giving Bill Barr the green light to spy on Americans' private information. And there, I could put together a list of the people that I might trust with that power. His name would not be near it. He goes on
I
to
can't
say
trust anybody with that power. Like, I wouldn't trust anyone with that power. I don't think that power should be entrusted.
Like Tom Hanks.
Not that I wouldn't. Well, Tom Hanks. Yeah. All right. So aside from Tom Hanks. No, honestly, like, not that I wouldn't trust anybody with it. I don't think anybody should be entrusted with it. Okay. It's just that's the difference.
Fair enough. And he goes on to say, the typical American may think to themselves, I've got nothing to worry about. I've done nothing wrong. The government has no reason to suspect me of anything. Why should I worry? Unfortunately, the question is not whether you did anything wrong. The question is whether a government agent believes they have the right to look at your web searches. And so I want to mention the thing about the four who didn't vote and the Bernie Sanders, because I saw some of what I would consider justifiable criticism of that, and the sum that goes way too far. And the thing is, it is one thing to say it failed by one vote, and so because of that, any one vote could have changed it. That seems like a thing we can say, but it requires a belief that the way that voting works is something is put forward, all of the senators go into a room and they think about it, and then they don't talk to each other, and they don't receive any sort of orders from above. And then they go in and they vote, which is not how it works. So that's 59. But if Bernie Sanders was going to vote, if the other four were going to vote, it wouldn't have been 59. Mitch McConnell wouldn't have freed up more Republicans to vote against it so that they can pretend that they have an actual problem with it. They knew the likelihood that it was to pass, and that influences the votes going into it. So look, perhaps if those others had showed up, it could have passed. But I don't think that it's by any means a guarantee, even if on paper it looks like that's the case.
Yeah, I that's clear and well put. And, you know, I don't know that these four senators, though, would have changed a ton of minds. It wasn't debated long enough. It wasn't talked about long enough. But I think Ron Wyden and certainly Steve Daines were persuasive enough on this. And I think that a lot of senators are going to look at this as a bad vote, and so when it comes back up again, I think it's going to be seen. I think that Wyden will prevail.
Okay, I certainly hope so. And you know, in the meantime, if you want to criticize those who didn't vote, and certainly those who voted against it, feel free to do that. But just think a little bit about what it actually represents. That's all I'm saying. And hopefully we'll return to it. Also, by the way, how long was it debated for? Was there any public, like, I follow a lot of internet news sites, so I was aware of it, but something as big as that, it seems like, shouldn't that be like a thing that the country is thinking about and talking about for a week before? Like, but no.
That's what I just said.
Yeah.
That's exactly what I'm saying. So it deserves more, and it will get more now.
I certainly hope so. Kids have been used as a bit of a football during this pandemic. The desire to reopen schools is being used as sort of an incentive to get people to accept reopening everything. You know, a lot of people are under pressure. The fact that they're suddenly having to homeschool their kids when they've never done that, never had any inclination to do that in the past. Yesterday, actually, Dr. Fauci was testifying before the Senate and said that kids would still potentially be at risk if they were to go back, let alone all of the adults that work at schools and when the kids return. We've heard rumors that kids spread germs from time to time. I know it's crazy. We're looking into it. Trump responded to Fauci's testimony, saying that he was surprised by Fauci's warning during Senate testimony this week, and that schools should be careful. I want to give you a little bit more of what he said, because he really did seem incensed by the fact that Fauci is being so openly critical of him.
Hey, Dr. Fauci is playing both sides. Are you suggesting that the advice he's giving to you is different?
I was surprised by his answer, actually, because, you know, it's just... To me, it's not an acceptable answer, especially when it comes to schools. The only thing that would be acceptable, as I said, is professors, teachers, etc., over a certain age. I think they ought to take it easy for another few weeks, 5 weeks, 4 weeks, who knows, whatever it may be. But I think they have to be careful, because this is a disease that attacks age, and it attacks health. And if you have a heart problem, if you have diabetes, if you're a certain age, it's certainly... much more dangerous. But with the young children, I mean, and students, it's really, just take a look at the statistics. It's pretty amazing.
That was pretty amazing.
It attacks age. It attacks health.
Right.
Oh, God. I just hope to get to the end of my life without ever finding myself part of a movement or a cult following a politician that requires you to accept so much obvious in-your-face stupidity on a daily basis.
Yeah.
But anyway, the kids, it's amazing when you look at the statistics. And so he's reasonable, though. He says the oldest professors, those with underlying conditions, should maybe consider taking 4, maybe 5 weeks off, and then that ought to do it. Let's check back in 5 weeks to see how many people are dying every day from coronavirus in America. But anyway, what's your reaction overall to this debate, Michael?
And let's send our kids to school so that they can contract the virus, maybe not have it affect them, but carry it to others. Let's do that. It's just another embarrassment. There's not much to say about it. Who am I going to trust in that conversation? It's implicit. And I think we're seeing that most Americans are trusting the same person I am and just kind of treading water with this guy.
Exactly. And look, overall, statistically, yes, kids don't seem to suffer as horribly when they have symptoms of coronavirus. They don't die at the same rate of, in particular, older individuals and those with underlying conditions. That is true. Let's bear in mind for 1 second that when we talk about, like, you'll often hear, like, Fox hosts say, the people who are dying had something else going on. And they're sort of like, they're vague about it. As if the things that would conspire with coronavirus to take you down are rare. But Trump actually admitted there. No, it's things like heart problems, diabetes. Diabetes is not rare in America. It is incredibly common. Millions and millions and millions and millions of Americans have it. So some of these complicating factors are not the sorts of things that show up on, like, you know, Dr. House or like document. Like, these are very common things that an increasing percentage of the American public have. So just understand that. When it comes to the kids, though, another thing that I want to remind everyone of, this is something that we talked about a couple of weeks ago, and it's that there is this syndrome that apparently seems linked to coronavirus that is having a big effect on kids, and that's now up to 15 states that are investigating cases that could be linked to either Kawasaki disease, or it looks like something that might function similarly to Kawasaki disease. It's a rare inflammatory condition that often impacts kids age 5 years or younger, and toxic shock syndrome. New York has now discovered 102 cases in children that show symptoms similar to that rare disease, and we're seeing it in more countries and more states, and about 60% of the 102 cases in New York tested positive for coronavirus. Of those cases, 70% were admitted into ICU and 19% resulted in intubation. And so that means that it does appear that these kids, while not suffering necessarily directly from coronavirus, there is an associated syndrome that can affect them, and when it does, it is serious, And New York, they've already lost 3 children to it. No, that's not 1,500, 2,000 a day like coronavirus, that the havoc it's wreaking on older Americans. But they're not immune to it in any way. They can spread it, and they can also apparently fall ill or fatally ill to this associated syndrome.
Yeah, not to mention that children are the least hygienic of the population, generally speaking, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, they're not concerned with that. They become petri dishes for this virus in which to live. And so I think that there is another danger that the people the right people are focusing on, but the other people are glossing over. And then you have this related illness that's happening right now, whether it's Kawasaki or toxic shock or something that combines the two. I don't know, obviously, but I do think that there's clearly enough evidence to say maybe we shouldn't open schools just yet.
Exactly. And like I get why the right is focusing on kids in their rhetoric, because obviously people are... they're very concerned about the lives of their kids. It's like it's the thing that drives our species to continue to exist. And so they have to convince people that there's no threat to them. And look, obviously there is a lower threat, but there is still a threat. Kids do still get severely sick from coronavirus. Kids do still die at limited numbers, but they do. And the fact that they completely ignore, still to this day, the obvious fact that they would spread it to adults at home is just so utterly dishonest. And that they do that layered on top of telling people for weeks now, like, your grandma's had a good run, you shouldn't worry about her. It's just so, so thoroughly immoral. In a time of crisis like this, the fact that what they're focusing on is trying to get people to set aside what empathy they have that remains after a difficult couple months of quarantine. It's the exact opposite thing out of what we should be able to expect from, you know, the biggest media company in the world, or in the country at the very least. But that's the direction they've gone in. We are trying to be honest and fair and factual here at The Damage Report when it comes to this pandemic. When there's bad news, we don't gloss over it. But we have also been looking out for good news and telling you that we will acknowledge it when the news is good. When deaths have been down for a couple of days, we've acknowledged it. And I want to acknowledge some good news now. We have been very, I think, justifiably critical of the lack of concern over testing coming from the federal government. But the numbers overall in that area have been trending in the right direction. Way too slowly, but you can see here the number of tests being done on a daily basis. You've had over the past couple of days an elevation to around 300 or so thousand tests being done on a daily basis. Now that is still too low. It's still too low, but that is better. And you can see that in fits and starts, it is going up. We're gonna have more on this. But Michael, good news. Yay.
Yeah, we'll take it. No. I mean, that's what we're hoping for. We're hoping that this is the beginning of a lot of that. And I don't think there's anyone among us who wouldn't just be ecstatic about that.
Exactly. And so that's about 300,000. You know, there's a great episode of Stephen Colbert, of John Oliver's show devoted to the question of testing. And he referred to a lot of experts saying that the bare minimum for a safe reopening of society would be at least 500,000, if not in the multiple millions per day. So, look, we're still far shy of that. A lot of work needs to be done, but we are moving apparently in the right direction. I want to be clear, though, about why we are moving in that right direction, and that is based on the evidence we have due to amazing work being done on the state level. That states are prioritizing this, in some cases, literally going abroad to purchase tests to bring back so that they can have more happen. Larry Hogan, is a great example of that. What they are not receiving still is enough support from the federal government. And right now, we have Trump's blueprint for testing. It explicitly leaves the problem to the states and the private sector, saying the federal government will only act as a supplier of last resort. And we know that over much of April, testing numbers stagnated due to supply shortages of swabs, reagents, and other materials they need to collect samples and run coronavirus tests. Now, the states have apparently done whatever they can to fill that gap, and that's why the numbers are going up. But they are still not receiving the support that they need from the federal government, who could be both using the DPA to get those numbers up here domestically, cutting deals with other countries to do what we can to, you know, fill the gap that way. And they're not doing that. And so this is progress. This is good news. But it could be a lot better right now if Trump had taken this seriously from the beginning, or even if he started to take it seriously now. That would be something. But so far, that's not what we're seeing.
No, it's not. And they also need a definition of what last resort is, right? I mean, at a certain point, you know, a lot of these places are looking for the last resort now. And if the federal government says they're the last resort, well, it's time to resort up. You know, I mean, I think that is that's part of the problem, too, is there was no definition about what would be a good deal of compliance from the states. And governors wanted that. They were craving that information from the federal government, and it was never defined. So some definition is certainly, and I think you'll hear Rick Bright talking about it as well, and you've heard others talk about it. There's just been this definition. Even today, the president, when you know, we were playing that about sending kids back to school, he said, I don't know, a number of weeks, five, four, but, you know, some weeks. Yeah, mm-hmm. There's no definition ever. Is it Easter yet? Right. I don't know. Yeah. And so I think that from top to bottom, there has to be that. And that's been lacking.
Yeah. One other measure, I'm not going to go super in detail, but one thing that the experts have been looking for is for our percentage of tests being conducted that come back positive for coronavirus to fall. Because as long as that is very high, it indicates that they are only testing people who almost certainly have this thing. They're reserving the tests for the worst case scenario. And as that number goes down, it represents a freeing up of tests for edge cases that are suspected but not, like, seriously believed. And we are seeing that number start to go down. It is nowhere near where it's at in some other countries. Some other countries have a positive test rate of 2 or 3%. We are far higher than that currently. But that is good news. I do want to balance the good news, though, with I have to reveal to you that while I'm continuing to track the death numbers every day, and they had gone down for 2 days, and then every day for the last four, they've been going up. What's interesting is that we are seeing a separation of the severity of the epidemic between New York in particular and the rest of the country. And when you just look at the national numbers, it hides that to some extent. So if you take a look at this, you're going to see the number of cases with the Connecticut, New Jersey, and New York area being the darker line. And that has been going down over the past couple of weeks, thankfully, especially because those are the worst hit in New York. And New Jersey as well has been very rough too. The cases outside of that area, though, are relatively stable for a couple of weeks now. So just understand that. And the quarantines are going away. Like, they were stable while we were socially distancing, and now we're not going to be. And you've probably seen the pictures of, like, the bars in, I think it was Milwaukee, that are just
Colorado,
packing.
Too.
Yeah, packing it in. No masks. Everybody shoulder to shoulder. Maybe there won't be a spike of coronavirus, but I find it hard to believe that it's a perfect situation for the spread of this virus that's being set up. And we'll see, because we're going to be able to break down the numbers by state. Assuming that the testing is actually happening, we'll be able to see which states see spikes and which don't.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's what we have to go with. And so it's plain to see already what the differences are. And now, as they pack the bars and they pack the beaches, let's see what happens.
Yeah. And, you know, we've got the beaches opening up in L.A., thankfully only for exercise. So apparently they're not packed. Not yet. But we'll see as weeks go by. We'll see. You know, maybe even here people might start to take it less seriously. Hopefully not. There is nothing funnier to me than the way conservatives, especially conservative guys, respond to Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. And I have an awesome example of it for you today. It happened when she responded to a tweet that had to do with billionaire philanthropy around coronavirus. So the tweet that she responded to, I want to show you. It is Scoop, Bill Gates, is exploring ways to convince other billionaires to donate more for coronavirus. Ideas that Gates has considered include launching a new COVID fund for billionaires who signed the Giving Pledge, per sources. Okay, so that sounds kind of good. She had a suggestion, though. If only there were some public fund billionaires could pay into, along with everyone else, that helps fund our infrastructure, hospitals, and public systems all at once. It could even be a modest percentage of what they earn every year. We could have an agency collect it and everything. And I responded thinking, well, that's a good idea, that is. And also, getting the point that she was making, because I am at least a minimally intelligent individual, rational, But not everyone was able to do that, even though she doubled down, saying if it helps, they could think of it as a subscription service to living in an advanced society. You almost can hear the wink wink. Just imagine billionaires paying enough so teachers in the US don't have to work multiple jobs and sell their own blood plasma to survive. Call me radical, but it might be worth it. I think you know where this is all going, because the replies missed all of the point. One individual said, it's no longer a donation if they have to pay. That's a tax. Juan says, oh yeah, good idea. It's existing though. It's called taxes. Yes. We get it. She gets it. That's the point. That's the joke. That's everything. And you wish that you could just coalesce into something and hit them over the head with it. How is it possible that you have the wherewithal to sign up for a social media website but not be able to get the most obvious point slash joke in the history of social media? And I showed you a couple, but you can go on there if you want, and it is all over the place. There are guys lining up to prove that they don't understand what is going on in the world around them. And look, she did a bit of the work for them, quote retweeting some of them. Now, I'm going to show you a few of these that she did. Now, you'll note that in all of these, the tweet is unavailable unless she screenshotted it. And that is because once these guys had pointed out to them their own obvious, willful, enthusiastic stupidity, they deleted the tweets and in some cases deleted their accounts. She at one point, quote, retweeted one with DJ Khaled voice, another one, which is just awesome. And that individual who deleted his tweet is the editor of the National Review. Ain't just some rando. I mean, in a fundamental way, we're all randos. We're all just living on this rock, hurtling through space. But he also is the editor of the National Review and tried to explain her joke to her. She had another one. This is from the policy head for Budget Hawks, Mark Goldwyn, saying this describes an income tax. It does describe an income tax. Saying that they lobby both parties for austerity policies in DC, aka cutting public safety nets when people need it most. I call it out because it matters when people who seek to influence policy are flippant and misogynistic towards members of Congress. And so what are you going to do? I mean, the thing is, how many of those guys that are like totally not getting it or trying to point out to her the joke that they don't get that she was already making think that she is dumb or that she just reads things off of a script or she is too stupid to be a representative? She has been faced with that from day one in elected office, from stupid, stupid, stupid guys, dense men telling her that she's too stupid to hold political office, as they can't even manage an interaction on social media. Like, everything in the world simultaneously is flying far above their head. But that's the world we live in. Just understand as you go about your day that these are the guys that we're dealing with. And by the way, little preview for tomorrow. The current front runner for my garbage person or people of the week has to do with this. Guys that are just too dumb for our society to continue to function. So look forward to that tomorrow. Very excited to welcome back to the program, after almost a year at this point, congressional candidate for Massachusetts 1st District, Alex Morse. Welcome back to the Damage Report.
Great. Thank you so much for having me back.
It's good to have you here. Obviously, wish that, you know, the country was in better shape right now. But we talked a little bit about your race back in July of last year. Probably quite a few people who are sort of catching on to what's going on in your race now. If people are tuning in here and they're not familiar with your history, what you're bringing to the race, why you're running, could you catch them up?
Yeah, absolutely. So I announced my campaign against Congressman Richard Neal about 10 months ago, last July. And this is a race that has national implications, given that Richard Neal is currently the chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee, the guy that refused to request President Trump's tax returns. And right now, the guy that is killing the Paycheck Guarantee Act in the House. And so this is one of the most important races in the country, because Richard Neal is a block to Medicare for All, to a Green New Deal, to getting money out of politics. And I was elected mayor of my hometown. I was 22 years old, became the youngest and the first openly gay mayor of my hometown. I've been mayor 9 years. I'm now 31 years old. And now we're just 3.5 months away from the primary on September 1st. And with Biden as the presumptive nominee, it's more important now than ever before that we have more progressive champions in Congress and we invest in a younger, more progressive bench of Democrats to be the leaders of our party.
You know, some of the things that you just pointed out about the not immediately requesting access to the taxes, which is a thing, by the way, that Democrats ran on in that cycle. That was like, hey, get us into power and we'll be able to do this. Oh, wait, what were we talking about? I forgot. Very difficult to understand. What I'm curious about is, as you pointed out, with Biden as the presumptive nominee and you going against this very well-connected, powerful Democrat, in the best of times, you'd face a lot of pushback from within the party. I'm curious, considering what's going on right now, what has the reaction from the party been?
Yeah, I mean, we have no direct interaction with the party, and we're not going to let the party obviously stop us from running the best possible campaign that we're running. I mean, here in the district, we have a lot of momentum. We're running to represent 87 cities and towns. We already have 25 times the amount of donors that live here in the district. And, you know, unlike the congressman, as a mayor here the last several weeks, I've been in the trenches with small business owners and entrepreneurs and residents who are struggling to put food on the table, to get health care, wondering how they're going to pay their rent or their next mortgage payment. And we need to really think about what type of member of Congress with what values and life experience do we want in Washington as we think about crafting a just recovery from this pandemic and from this crisis. And Congressman Neal, time and time again, is motivated by his corporate donors. I mean, right now he takes more corporate PAC money than any member of the House, Democrat and even Republican. And he's more interested in working with Trump than actually holding him accountable.
You know, you mentioned a just recovery and you talked about the fact that he was instrumental in blocking Representative Jayapal's Paycheck Guarantee Program. So I'm curious, if you were in the seat right now, the bill that was put forward just less than a week ago, what do you make of it? What do you think about what's in there? What do you think should have been added that wasn't?
Yeah, there's a couple of good things in there, but this is a larger point about Democrats failing to use their leverage. They did the first few pieces of legislation here. You know, no bill is going to go to President Trump's desk without going through the House. And we need a united front of Democrats in the House of Representatives actually crafting a bill that bails out people and not corporations. And I would be hand in hand, arm in arm with Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal and other progressive members of Congress demanding that the speaker include the Paycheck Guarantee Act and include more stimulus to the American people. This is a no-brainer. And for Democrats and Republicans to talk about, well, we need to find a way to pay for this, we're not paying for any of this. And, you know, as a proponent of modern monetary theory, this is important that we have the funds when we have the political will to actually make a difference in people's lives. And if we have money for the biggest corporations to transfer trillions of dollars to the Fed, to spend trillions of dollars on war and defense, we have money for college affordability to help people put food on the table, to give people a paycheck when they're not having any money come in. And so I wouldn't, you know, close my eyes and let this bill go through without joining progressive colleagues to demand that it change.
You know, I know it's obviously difficult for you to get a lot of like direct contact with your current constituents, your potential future constituents, but I'm curious, to the extent that you've been able to get an impression from them, what do you think they're making of the response from government so far, from the Trump administration, but also the counter proposals from the Democratic Party? What do you think they're making of the situation that we're in right now?
Yeah, people are hurting. It's a very uncertain time. People are scared, and they see a federal government, not just the president, but their member of Congress. You know, how is this relief trickling down and helping just everyday people? I mean, you would never know that we have one of the most powerful members of Congress representing us when you just talk to everyday people. And our congressman is spending his time talking to CEOs of hospitals and of companies, while I'm spending my time talking to employees and working people and just everyday residents of Holyoke and in other communities throughout our district. We've launched a 6-part town hall series in a number of cities throughout the district to hear firsthand from people. My campaign has made 30,000 wellness calls to people in the district just over the last 4 weeks alone. And again, the House, even with a Democratic majority, signed off on an insane amount of money for corporate and special interests without any direct oversight. And we're already seeing millions of dollars go to friends of President Trump, private jet companies, big corporate chains. Meanwhile, I'm talking to folks that don't have internet at home, don't have broadband in their community, can't find access to a medical professional, don't know how they're going to pay their rent in a couple of weeks. Those are the things that members of Congress should be focusing on. But I mean, if we're not interacting or talking to the people you represent, how would you know that?
Yeah, and by the way, this is a quick aside. Thank you for mentioning the fact that we sort of just take it for granted if you live in one of the big cities that, yeah, every American has access to internet and probably high-speed access, but that is definitely not the case. And look, I live in LA, so I have access to any number of different providers. I cannot imagine having gone through the past 2 months without that extra, that layer of access to what's going on. To like how isolated you must feel. If you don't have access to that, and a lot of the people in elected office just take it for granted that, that's available.
Yeah, absolutely. And then we expect kids and teachers to have access to education online. I mean, we gave out 1,500 laptops to students in our public schools that didn't have devices at home, and we were able to provide 6 months of free internet. The city was, for any family that didn't have internet connection at home. And there are still dozens of cities and towns in the first district represented by Congressman Neal. They don't have any connectivity to internet whatsoever. And so these are the challenges that, people are faced with here in this district. And again, it's time we have a member of Congress that's going to fight tooth and nail to bring resources back to the district to improve people's quality of life. He's the chair of the Ways and Means Committee. Massachusetts is getting, I think, is ranked towards the bottom of all 50 states in terms of the money they're getting for hospitals. Here in Holyoke, we have one of the last community hospitals in the state not qualifying for a lot of federal aid. And just last week, our one psychiatric hospital here in Western Mass is laying off over 200 employees and closing psychiatric beds at a time where mental health services are more important now than ever before. And so tell me how your power is benefiting this district.
Yeah. And you're down to just it's 3 more months of campaigning before the primary date?
Yeah, about 3.5 more months until September 1st.
And where can people find out more about the race, but also about your platform and what you're doing during the pandemic?
Yeah, I would encourage people to go to alexmorseforcongress.com. Check out this race. We're in the final 3.5 months. We're having one of our best quarters of the campaign so far. We have a lot of momentum. Really grateful to have the support of progressive organizations nationally, people from all 50 states. But we need to win this race on the ground. We're never going to have the millions of dollars Congressman Neal has from Wall Street, fossil fuel companies, and Big Pharma. But we're going to have the support of everyday people, working people across the country and here in Western Mass. And we're going to get this done on September 1st.
Alex Morse, thank you once again for joining us. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks so much, John.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.